The battlefield in Pennsylvania remains enveloped in myth and glory and is hallowed ground in national history with its Little Round Top, Devil's Den, and the Peach Orchard. Gettysburg is a place where Robert E. Lee gambled wrong with Pickett's charge, which sent men up a slope over hundreds of yards of open ground and straight into the teeth of Northern artillery. And despite all of that, they almost made it. Today, a conversation with the author of a new book on the pivotal battle as we approach the 150th anniversary of the battle. Alan Gelzo's new book is Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. He's the Henry Luce Professor of the Civil War Era and Director of Civil War Era Studies at Gettysburg College. He joins us now from his office. And Alan, it's a pleasure to have you. Good morning.
Well, it's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
There are a couple of major reenactments scheduled for the coming days, but I see that neither of them is scheduled to take place on the actual battlefield, Alan. Why not?
Well, for one thing, the Park Service has a responsibility for maintenance of the battlefield, and reenactments involve lots of people. They also involve lots of trash.
Yeah.
They generate that. And then there's simply the unseemliness of doing the battle again on the place where the soldiers actually fought.
Hmm.
There's a sense that this ground has already been hallowed. It would almost be like a very strange form of play acting to hold the reenactment on the battlefield itself. Now, that much said, there has been in the past some reenactment.
I was going to say,
on the battlefield.
Yeah.
In fact, as long ago as, believe it or not, 1922, the United States Marines actually staged a reenactment of Pickett's charge, not in Confederate uniforms. They did it in their regular Marine Corps uniforms with Marine Corps weapons of 1922. Not a lot of attention to historical accuracy, but they did it.
Well, there was that movie, Gettysburg, with Jeff Daniels and others that came out a few years ago, maybe in the late 80s, early 90s. That was sort of staged on the actual battlefield, wasn't it?
Some parts of it.
Okay.
Not all of it, though. Some parts of it. And the parts that were done on the battlefield tended to be those which were off the beaten path and were not going to open up the Park Service to some kind of charge that they were letting the hallowed ground become commercialized by movie making.
What kind of crowds are expected in Gettysburg the next few days?
Significant.
Yeah.
We have heard estimates that run anywhere from 1 to 2 million people.
My goodness. What do you make of the fact that so many people are showing up for a battle, you know, that took place 150 years ago?
Well, for one thing, it's still very much alive in American imagination. You mentioned the Gettysburg film. That has had a major part in keeping Gettysburg current in people's memories. Another thing is the overall compelling interest that the Civil War continues to exert on people. And Gettysburg is a central event of the war, which in turn leads to a third thing, and that is how important Gettysburg was as a battle, as a turning point, as a decisive moment. And then within the battle itself, the last thing is that there's so many tremendous stories that are built into the battle itself. There are some Civil War battles where it can be a very cut-and-dry sort of affair. X marched up to Y, and they shot it out. Well, it's not nearly that simple at Gettysburg. Gettysburg is really a collection of firefights, of individual combats, of one unit facing off against another unit, each of which turns out differently and provides a different story, a unique brick in a very unique wall.
You know, I got to applaud you for some of the details that you have in this book, and I forget, forgive me now for forgetting exactly where I read this in the book, but at one point you talk about the number of shots being fired in the woods, maybe at Little Round Top at Gettysburg, you know, and branches and big limbs tumbling down, and the birds in the trees sort of being confused and not knowing where to go, and actually landing on the shoulders of the soldiers themselves.
Sure, the birds, in their own way, had made their own calculation as to where it was safest. And one place that certainly was not safe was up on the branches of those trees because of the overshooting that tended to occur. So you get this very strange situation where the sparrows have lighted on the shoulders of Union soldiers on Culp's Hill, and it's almost as though they're tame. Well, they're not tame. They're just being smart.
Yeah, wow. You work in Gettysburg, as I introduced you a few minutes ago, Alan, at the college there. Can you see anything of the battlefield when you look out your window?
I'm looking out the window right now, and I'm looking at the battlefield.
Hmm.
Because, in truth, everything here was part of the battlefield. Everything here was fought over. And the college campus was at the center of the first day's fighting. our main building here, Pennsylvania Hall, which dates from before the battle, was used as a hospital and as an observation post during the battle. So when people ask me that, I'm always happy to say, I have my office right on the battlefield. And that wows people, but that's because the whole town, the whole area north and west of town, and especially the area south of the town, Cemetery Hill, Cemetery Ridge, Little Round Top, all of these were being fought over in an area of about 16 square miles.
I'm guessing this all gave you something of a home field advantage.
I would like to think so, because, you know, I've walked this ground so much that you do, in fact, start to develop something of a sense of an eye for what could be seen, what could be done, what people could know at specific times, how far away they were, and given 19th century battlefield communications, how fast things could actually happen. And I suppose the one big lesson you draw out of this is there's one single word that can be applied to the rate at which this battle was fought, and that is slow.
Because
for one thing, there are no field telephones, there's no field telegraph, there's no way of commanding instant communication between one part of the battlefield and another. So that if you have, just to give you an example, if you have orders coming from, let's say, Corps headquarters, okay, they've got to go down to division headquarters, they've got to go down to brigade, then down to regimental level. That whole process for one set of orders can take up to 45 minutes. And then if somebody down at the very bottom of there doesn't understand some of the details, is scratching their head, their option is either to go ahead by their own lights or send a runner back for clarification. All right, there goes another 45 minutes and then 45 minutes to get back. At the end of the day, it really takes a long time for things to happen.
Yeah, I was really struck in your book as you described the third day, the pivotal third day with Pickett's charge, sort of the delay at the start of the charge and, you know, orders going back and forth, no one really knowing exactly what's about to happen here. Lee wants it to happen. Longstreet does not. And there's a hesitation even at that very, very important moment.
They're having to wait, for one thing, until the federal artillery on Cemetery Hill has been, if not absolutely silenced, then at least persuaded to keep its head down below the barriers. And waiting for that is the real crux of it, because the Confederate infantry is not really going to find it practical to make this charge unless that federal artillery has been silenced first. And that's what they spend the better part of an hour attempting to do. As soon as it's clear that that has happened, then the word has to go to the infantry. The infantry has to step out, develop its lines, form up into line of battle, and then begin moving. And actually, it takes longer to get ready to do that than it actually does to make the charge.
Wow.
It only takes about 20 minutes to get across the field of Pickett's charge at the most.
You know,
getting ready for it is another matter entirely.
We'll talk about Pickett's charge more in our second half, because I have so many questions about what was going through the mind of Robert E. Lee at that very important moment. You know, I don't mean to get too mythical, too spiritual here, but as you walk the battlefield on days when lots of tourists aren't there, you know, and given what happened, the horrors that happened, you know, on so many of those acres, I'm wondering, what do you hear? What do you pick up as you walk the land out there?
That's hard to say. I try as professionally as possible not to let the imagination run riot.
Sure, sure.
And we certainly have some people who do. We have, for instance, here in Gettysburg, ghost tours, which I have to say I really have a lot of difficulty with. And there are moments when I probably am being more rational and hard-headed in my approach just to compensate than maybe I should be. But at the same time, it is a great thing to be able to see in the mind's eye what the battle itself looked like, the long lines of infantry, the close columns of maneuver, and then also to realize that for the most part, the soldiers who were fighting here couldn't see any of that themselves, because they're fighting with black powder, single-shot muzzle-loading weapons that kick out enormous amounts of smoke. And during the battle, most of the soldiers really couldn't see very far at all, because the gun smoke has created what amount to kind of banks of London fog, so thick that at times soldiers said that it actually blotted out the sun.
You know, I was really struck by that as I went through here. I guess I hadn't realized there was that much smoke on the battlefield that day. What did that do to their ability to fight? I guess it's obvious, but there must be lots of stories of shots being fired at the wrong people, I'm guessing?
Oh, all the time. And a lot of fumbling around, a lot of hesitation, a lot of uncertainty as to where the enemy is. Some units in the wheat field on July 2nd were firing only in the direction that they saw the flame of other fire in the distance. That was the only thing they could see penetrating through the murk. And what they were hoping was those were Confederates on the other side of those rifles. Hmm. That they couldn't be absolutely sure of that. So certainly there was friendly fire incidents. But even more, it was just confusion, hesitation, and above all, isolation. I mean, confusion you're going to have any time. Isolation, that's part of a battlefield. But just simply not really knowing what's going to happen next, where anyone else is, that's the really disorienting feature of 19th century warfare, and especially here at Gettysburg.
Hmm. So, and you point this out in the book, that this battle is much more reminiscent, this war really, much more reminiscent of the Revolutionary War than it is anything we find with World War I, you know, coming 40, 50, 60 years down the road.
Sure. Let me just give you one statistic to illustrate that. In the American Civil War, approximately 15% of the casualties were sustained from artillery fire. That means that most of the wounds and death are the result of infantry fire and infantry fire combat.
Mm-hmm.
In World War I, over 60% of the casualties were inflicted by artillery.
Wow.
That means that most of the time, soldiers in the 1914-18 war really didn't even see the other side. They were being hurt, they were being killed, at long distance, so to speak. In the Civil War, you can't do that. The weaponry is comparatively short range. Even though you now have techniques and new technologies such as rifling of artillery and muskets, those really do not dramatically change the problems that are imposed. They actually have problems of their own. And there's still the business of the powder smoke. So take it all together, what you're really looking at Gettysburg is something which looks a lot more like the last of the 18th century wars or the Napoleonic Wars than it does like the first of the modern wars, where artillery is the real killing factor.
That's so interesting. Alan Gelzo is our guest. He's the author of a new book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. It's out just on the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg back in 1863. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. If you want to speak with Alan, our email address, UpToDate, at KCUR.org. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Some folks already waiting to speak to Alan. The Civil War is such a big, hot topic, even in our neck of the woods here. Gary from Shawnee. Gary, good morning.
I'm coming in okay.
Yeah, you're fine, Gary. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. My question has to do with the line formation on either the north or the south side. And during the Revolutionary War, guerrilla tactics seemed to work so well against the British. Why was that not adapted further by either the north or south to gain victories? And I would be happy to take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Gary. Why not more guerrilla-type warfare, Alan?
Well, there was a lot of guerrilla-type warfare in some places, especially places like Missouri and Tennessee. But by and large, there are two things to keep in mind that make a difference here. First of all, the American Revolution was not won by guerrilla activity. That certainly contributed its bit. But what really made the difference in the Revolutionary War was the good old-fashioned line-of-battle stand-up combat that George Washington and the Continental Army, along with the French, fight against the British. That's what really makes the Revolution successful for Americans. In the Civil War, they're still fighting line-of-battle because that's the most efficient way to deliver fire. The weaponry of both the Revolution and the Civil War was successful by volume rather than by unit, so that it was important to try to bunch together and concentrate as many shooters as possible to deliver that fire as one flying package. You didn't try to isolate individual targets. That's something that we do in modern military training, but it's something that really would have been impossible in 1863. So in that respect, a soldier who had been fighting in the Revolution is someone who is not going to find the American Civil War battlefield actually all that different in a lot of respects. Bigger because there are larger armies, but the actual experience of combat, actually not all that different.
You know, Ellen, you talked a minute ago about the power of imagination when it comes to the Civil War, when it comes to Gettysburg. You begin your book by taking the reader to the old Indian lookout on South Mountain, I gather just outside of Gettysburg. What would you have seen if you were standing on that location, on that lookout in late June of 1863, just prior to this battle?
First thing you would have seen would have been towering columns of smoke. They would have looked like the breadth of an F5 tornado. And this would just have been ascending in a huge column straight up into the heavens, because on July 3rd, there really wasn't much breeze. Mm-hmm. So that huge column is the first thing that you're going to see, and that you can see that for miles. If you have a decent telescope, especially if you're a member of the United States Signal Corps, and you have a good brass naval telescope, you can actually pick out the maneuvering of some units, even from that distance. If you have enough elevation, if you've got a platform, which they usually constructed, or even if you shinny up in a tree with it, you have a remarkably good line of sight from there to the scene of Pickett's charge. So you could actually see a remarkable amount, and people who were there at the time record some of what they saw. Everybody mentions the smoke, the towering column of smoke.
I was also struck by what else people mentioned, which was the smell. That sometimes when the armies would advance and march into Gettysburg, for instance, you could tell they were coming even before you could see them. You could smell them. Why could they smell them?
Let's say that hygiene was not one of the top priorities of the American Civil War armies, simply because there really wasn't a whole lot that you could do about it. You do not have frequent changes of clothing, of uniforms. You have terrible nutrition, terrible diet, which wreaks its havoc on the alimentary canal. And taking everything together, these armies really smelled rancid. And even if you couldn't see the Confederate Army or the Union Army, you could probably smell it when it was within a certain distance. I know that doesn't sound terribly complimentary or terribly romantic, but you know, truth be told, if you ask veterans of World War II who were in the campaigns in Europe in 1944 to 45, they'll tell you, if you pin them hard enough, that it really wasn't all that much different for them. When you're constantly living in the rough, when you're constantly in the out-of-doors and you really don't have opportunities for a lot in the way of change of clothing, of bathing, even of necessary functions, then everybody smells incredibly bad. And, you know, that was as true at the Battle of the Bulge as it was at the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah. Well, have a great lunch hour, everybody. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with Ellen Gelzo and his new book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. We'll talk about Pickett's charge and exactly what Robert E. Lee was thinking that morning. Also, try to understand a little more about why Lee wanted to take his forces so far north into Pennsylvania at that point in the war. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting for this segment with Ellen Gelzo, the author of a new book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. This is this week and next week, the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, the turning point of the Civil War. Ellen, why did Robert E. Lee take his forces so far north at that relatively late point in the war?
Because Lee knew, really from the very beginning of the Civil War, that the South could not win the war if it tried to fight strictly on the defensive, if it just tried to hold its ground and fend off the Union. The North, he said, was much too strong, had too many advantages in the way of resources and manpower to outlast that kind of effort. Instead, the only way the war was going to be won would be if Southerners took the war onto Northern territory early and swiftly and scored a knockout blow of some kind. That would have a domino effect politically and convince the Northern public that the war couldn't be won, and they would take that into the voting booth, and that would be the wake-up call to Congress and to the president that it was time to call it quits and move to the negotiating table.
And do you think he was right about that?
Ultimately, he was making a very logical argument that way, because we're talking, 1863? It's the third summer of the war. It's dragged on that long. And there is dissent, especially over Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which went into effect on the 1st of January, 1863. In the off-year elections for Congress, Republicans lose 36 seats in the House of Representatives. They lose the governorships of New York and New Jersey. Well, in 1863, there are now two more governorships coming up for re-election that are in Republican hands and are likely to go Democrat. If those states join the Democratic column, that's going to provide enough political mass to bring the administration to heel and tell Lincoln it's time to call it quits. We can't win this war. We'll have to negotiate. That is what Lee is counting upon.
You know, a lot of people think that the Battle of Gettysburg, you know, more or less happened by accident, that the two armies ran into each other in south-central Pennsylvania and had this big collision. But you point out that that really wasn't the case at all.
No. I mean, to a certain extent, every Civil War battle is the result of a collision, because these armies, again, are limited by what the communications technology can tell them about each other's whereabouts. So there's a sense in which Gettysburg is really like all the others. All the others were really, you know, they didn't happen according to timetables or objective points. That kind of language and that kind of thinking is more a matter of the modern military. In the 19th century, it's very different. And Lee himself was not the kind of man who left things to chance. He had already put his finger down on the map and said, if we move into Pennsylvania and the Army of the Potomac, the principal northern army in the Eastern Theater, if they come after us, we'll probably fight them either around Frederick, Maryland, or Gettysburg. So he had identified the general area. What's more, on the Union side, one of General Meade, who was commanding the Army of the Potomac, one of General Meade's principal corps commanders, John Reynolds, had already made up his mind that he was moving up to Gettysburg to hold that position because he regarded it as extremely important. So on both the Union and the Confederate sides, there was a real sense of the importance of Gettysburg and the Gettysburg area. The real question is not whether they collided by accident. The question is, did the Union Army upset Robert E. Lee's timetable by getting to Gettysburg faster than he thought they were going to get there? That's the X factor.
Because they were able to hold the high ground and gain the high ground by being there first.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Back to some calls here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Up to date at kcur.org is our email address. At kcur, up to date, is our tweet, Twitter handle. Let's go to Jerry from Holt, Missouri. Jerry, good morning.
Good morning. I was listening earlier, a few minutes ago, and they talked about, you mentioned something about a spiritual aspect to Gettysburg. And very quickly, I'll share a little brief incident with you. Several years ago, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I wanted to travel back to D.C., and I wanted to visit the wall. And I knew from talking to people that it was very likely that when I got to the wall, I would have an emotional feeling inside of myself.
Sure.
So I was prepared for that. I happened to go to Gettysburg just because I like history, and I wanted to see it. So that day I went out by myself, and I just went walking across the battlefield. And what I was not prepared for at all is that I only got so far out there, and all of a sudden I had this feeling come over me. My legs got very weak. I literally fell down on the ground. My legs went out from under me. I started bawling uncontrollably. And at that moment, the only words that came into my mind were Abraham Lincoln's when he referred to that as hallowed ground. And so there is something there, and I just thought I'd share that. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. Jerry, I'm glad you called. Thank you for the good call.
You know, that is a good word. Let me add something to his perception of things. After the Battle of Gettysburg, one of the major projects here was the creation of the Soldiers' National Cemetery, and there are about 3,900 of those who were killed in the Battle of Gettysburg who are buried there. That's, of course, where Lincoln delivers his Gettysburg Address.
Mm-hmm.
But that by no means guarantees that every body of a soldier was retrieved, and they weren't. I can point you to places on the battlefield which were burial pits, which were never exhumed. And there certainly, when we talk about Gettysburg as hallowed ground, what we really have to mean that literally. This is still very much a graveyard. This is a burial place. It's not just a battlefield. It's not just a National Park Service site. You are treading on ground that, for all that we know, there are soldiers still at rest there who were missed when the exhumations took place.
Hmm. Let's go to Bruce from Meriden, Kansas. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I have a photograph. It's a 8x36 photograph, a large panorama photograph of the Gettysburg battlefield that I've never seen anywhere else online. It was taken by a Mr. Williams, who was a kind of an unofficial Gettysburg photographer there, and it shows the 1938 final encampment of the veterans of the battle. And it shows hundreds upon hundreds of large white tents for these very old men to spend the last few days in. It's the final encampment was between June 29 and July 6th of 1938.
Wow.
Which would be 75 years after the battle and also 75 years ago this week.
You know, we actually had two of those huge reunions of blue and gray, the first of which was in 1913 for the 50th anniversary of the battle, and President mm-hmm. Woodrow Wilson was here and spoke here for that. And then in 1938, 75th anniversary, you have the last handfuls of survivors of the Civil War, and they come here, these very fragile elderly men, and Franklin Roosevelt, as president, comes and speaks here and dedicates the Eternal Peace Light Monument on the battlefield. And there's a terrible grinding irony about that, because here you had these old veterans of the war who are brought together for what for them is really going to be the last time.
Mm-hmm.
And the dedication of a peace monument, and yet at the same moment, this is 1938, we're right on the verge of mm-hmm. Hitler and Munich. Kristallnacht is going to happen in November of 1938. The world is going to be convulsed in a gigantic world war in little more than a year. And you think, haven't we learned?
Yeah.
Haven't we learned? You know, these Civil War veterans could tell us everything we need to know about the horrors of war, but we're going to go again. And the irony of that is something which really has to impress itself on anyone who stands there and sees the Eternal Peace Light Monument today, because one thing we have not enjoyed in our times is eternal peace.
Yeah. Bruce, thank you for the call.
Sure.
Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on Up to Date with Alan Gelzo, author of Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, Alan, I got a question concerning immigrant troops, because I know there were some German immigrants on
yes.
which side, but which nationalities on both sides of the fighting and the languages they spoke, and how did that affect the fighting?
The 11th Corps of the Army of the Potomac was probably about half German. Now, when we say German, that tended to cover either second generation of immigrants who were, you know, men who were actually born here, but also a very large number of immigrants directly from Germany. In many of the regiments, the German regiments of the 11th Corps, they were still giving orders in German.
Hmm.
And many of the senior officers in that corps had been formerly members of various German military organizations. There were some who had been in the Prussian army, one in the army of the King of Saxony, another in the army of the King of Baden. There were a lot of Germans in the 11th Corps. Now, that much said, so many other nationalities are represented in so many other units on both sides. A very large percentage of both armies had Irish units. In the Army of the Potomac, there was the Irish Brigade. There were individual units which had nationalities. For instance, the 39th New York Regiment. It was known as the Garibaldi Guard because it was raised mostly from Italian immigrants, although it had a couple of companies of Hungarians and French. There were Englishmen. There were Hungarians. There were Austrians. There was even one Chinese soldier in the 14th Connecticut.
Hmm.
So this was really a very universal kind of conflict. Not that people were fighting on behalf of other nations, but that so many other nations had representatives, so to speak, among the various units and formations of both of these armies.
Frank, thank you for the call. You know, again, sometimes these little details stand out stood out to me so much as I read through this book, Alan. You pointed out in here that President Lincoln was so distraught when he found out that his general, George Meade, failed to pursue the defeated, you know, Lee and the Confederate forces at the end of the Gettysburg fighting after the third day, that he was said to have broken down and actually cried. Tell us a little more about that.
Abraham Lincoln was not a very emotional person.
No.
He was someone who prized rationality, reason, logic, and that was his great strength. But when he discovered that Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia had, in fact, escaped across the Potomac into Virginia, that George Meade and the Army of the Potomac had not pressed their advantage and destroyed Lee's army, he was shocked. And his son, Robert Todd Lincoln, who was home on vacation from Harvard, came into his father's office in the White House and just found his father with his head down on the desk, weeping. And his father said, "We had them in the palm of our hands. We had only to close our fingers. And we didn't. We let them get away." Lincoln was so intent on seeing the Battle of Gettysburg followed up, that victory at Gettysburg followed up with a final destruction of the Confederate Army, that he actually sent a message to Meade personally, telling Meade, "If you attack and are unsuccessful, I will take the blame. If you attack and are successful, then burn this message and you can have all the credit." He was that intent on it, but it didn't happen. And it was one of the greatest disappointments of the war, because the war is now going to drag on for another 21 months.
Yeah, right. And Meade didn't do it. He had his reasons. And you talk about the reasons in the book. Why didn't he do it?
Partly because the Army of the Potomac, although it is the victorious army at Gettysburg, had really been shellacked pretty badly. And even though the Confederate Army was, if anything, in worse condition, still, Meade's army was in disarray. And his concern was that he could take this victory he'd won at Gettysburg and throw it all away in a mismanaged effort to try to get even more, to try to get extra points, so to speak. That was one thing. And Meade, of course, is a man who is by nature and temperament cautious. Mm-hmm. He's only been put in command of this army 3 days before the battle.
Yes.
So he's still trying to sort things out himself. And in the process, he wants to go carefully. If he goes off half-cocked, he could lose everything. I think the ultimate consideration, though, is that Meade and Lincoln are not on the same political wavelength. And Meade is really convinced that if he wins a great battle, he won't really get any credit for it. But if he loses, his head will be on a pike along with all the other losing generals before him.
You know, there is some irony here, because just a few months before, Meade had turned on his own mentor, George McClellan, who had led the Union forces, for not taking enough risks.
Sure. He says in a war, Meade writes this in a letter, he says, in a war, generals have to take risks. What's the use of being in a war if you're not going to take risks? And I've often wondered, couldn't somebody have given him exactly that advice back?
Yeah.
It would have made things very different in the pursuit of Lee to the Potomac.
This is so interesting. Alan Gelzo is our guest at his new book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. We're talking as we approach the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, I want to turn to the third and final day of the fighting and Pickett's Charge, which is this all-out rush by the South against the North, over 500 yards or even more of open ground and heading uphill, too. This was Lee's big gamble to basically win the war. But anyone, you know, who has stood at the top of that hill looking down at where Lee sent his men, you just had to wonder, and I did this a few years ago, you just had to wonder what in the world he was thinking. But interesting to me, Alan, you found some recent precedent, at least back in those days, for why Lee did what he did that maybe put his decision in a little more context. What did you find out about all that?
One of the things that I think sets Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, apart from other books on Gettysburg, and believe me, their number is legion,
yes,
is the sense of context I tried to place the battle in. Not just to look at Gettysburg in isolation, but to compare it more broadly to military operations in Europe and in other places. And when you look at it in that context, suddenly Pickett's Charge begins to make a lot more sense. Because that was exactly the kind of tactic that is used successfully by the British at the Battle of the Alma in 1854 in the Crimean War. It's used by the French in the North Italian War at Solferino in 1859. So when Lee decides that he is going to make this frontal assault across what at its longest was almost 1,400 yards, that he's going to do that, he's not behaving irrationally. He's not throwing a Hail Mary pass. He's really operating on the basis of some very good examples before him, and he had every reason to expect that this was going to work, if only because the Union Army had just gone through 2 days of battering, and really it looked like it was on the ropes. All he had to do was close in with Pickett's division and finish off the job.
But he does this, and that context was really helpful for me, but by all means. But he does this, General Lee sends his men, and sitting right at his right elbow is James Longstreet, shaking his head and more or less saying, "General, don't do it. You're making a mistake."
Well, Longstreet thought it was a mistake in the first place for Lee to have tried to attack, to have gone on the offensive and taken the tactical offensive himself. Longstreet's feeling
was a little
bit far better.
You mean even going to Gettysburg, you mean, Alan?
Well, the whole campaign.
The whole campaign, okay. Yeah.
He had no objections to moving into Pennsylvania, per se, although he really, in his heart of hearts, believed it would have been far better if part of the Army of Northern Virginia had been carved off and sent to the West to help the Confederate situation there. But once in Pennsylvania, Longstreet was happy to play along right up until the moment when Lee decides he is actually going to attack himself. Longstreet questions that. I have to think, though, that Longstreet's questioning of Lee was a lot more intense in the years after the battle than it was at the time itself. In other words, Longstreet is, in 15 or 16 years after the battle, beginning to remember his descent from Pickett's charge much more vividly than it actually existed at the time. Because he does, in fact, set things up. He does, in fact, give overall charge to, overall oversight of the charge. And he's the one who's really directing it. If he has questions, they are comparatively muted. He had plenty of opportunity to respond to Lee and to tell Lee, this is a really bad idea. We should really not do this. And that is not, in fact, advice that Lee is going to take.
You know, all of this happens, and maybe in fairness to Robert E. Lee, it is interesting just how close the Confederates came to gaining control on top of that hill. How close did they get, Alan?
You could almost measure it in yards. One brigade of Confederate infantry did, in fact, manage to barge through the Union defensive line at what we sometimes call the angle, right behind Cemetery Hill.
Mm-hmm.
If they had managed to keep on going, or if there had been two more brigades behind them, mm-hmm. supporting them, then there would have been nothing to have stopped the Confederate Army from plowing right through and rupturing the Union line, getting in the rear of Cemetery Hill, cutting off the supply routes of the Tawnytown Road and the Baltimore Pike. And it could have been curtains right there. The Union Army might have done as it had done 2 months before at Chancellorsville, just gone to pieces in a rout. And it could have happened that way. It came so close that really the only thing standing between those Confederates and that result were one or two regiments of Union infantry. Well, there were no two more brigades to come up because when Lee invades Pennsylvania, Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, points to two of Pickett's brigades and says, "You have to hold these back at Richmond to protect the Confederate capital." Those were the brigades of Montgomery Corse and Micah Jenkins. If Jenkins and Corse's brigades had been with Pickett at Gettysburg, and if they had been coming right through that line, then it could have been curtains and game over for the Army of the Potomac, for the Union, and maybe even for Abraham Lincoln and the United States as a whole.
You know, given that, was Jeff Davis's decision then the wrong one, or did it make sense?
Well, it certainly made sense.
Yeah.
But who, of course, could have thought of the consequence of it weeks later at a place more than 150 miles away from Richmond? Now, there are some contingencies that you just cannot possibly anticipate. That just turned out to be one of them.
You know, as someone who has spent so much time on this material, what do you make ultimately of Robert E. Lee's decision to send his men on Pickett's charge? What's your bottom line with it?
If I had been in Lee's position, I would have done the same thing.
Hmm.
I think that all the signs pointed in the direction that Lee took. Many people asked, still ask today, these questions about Lee and whose decision made the difference, and was it because Lee wasn't thinking right? Was it because Longstreet wasn't cooperating? Was it because Richard Ewell didn't do this or Jeb Stuart didn't do it? This all goes on. But, you know, the person who actually had the most prescient comment was George Pickett, who is not normally regarded as being one of the brighter bulbs in the Confederate chandelier.
Mm-hmm.
Pickett said, you know, I think the Yankees had something to do with it.
Hmm.
And at the end of the day, that really is the reason why. The battle is not lost because Lee made the wrong decision or Longstreet made the wrong decision. Really, at the end of the day, it comes back to those Union soldiers who fought tenaciously
mm-hmm.
at the angle, who would not give up. Union soldiers who took it on their own hook without orders, without direction from generals on high, but on their own initiative in small groups and clumps to pitch in, make the right decisions, show up at the right place at the right time. That was what made the difference.
Wow. Well, Alan, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. You were just money. What a great conversation. And again, Alan Gelzo's new book is Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. Thank you so much for your time, Alan. I really enjoyed it. And good luck in the couple of weeks ahead as all kinds of folks come to visit Gettysburg.
Thank you much, and we'll be sure to keep our heads down.
You bet. Thanks, Alan.
Okay.
Again, Alan Gelzo is the director of Civil War Era Studies program at Gettysburg College. He's the author of Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. Well, tomorrow on the show, are multivitamins as beneficial as the label leads us to believe? We'll look at some pros and cons of these nutrient-packed pills, plus why you're more likely to get a ticket in Mission than any other Kansas City suburb. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Caitlin Brennan, and Sangeeta Shastri. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.